in different places. Of course, I've been following this topic for the last few years, but my own research focus has been slightly quite limited, as it is in most cases when you are really trying to go in depth in certain things. Here are some quite, I would say, big money, large scale, and influential projects to measure, somehow quantify teacher quality. So I'll give a few examples. And one is a quite recent MEET, MET project, measuring teacher quality. And it is funded by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And tens of millions of dollars has been put into this project. And they have come up with different reports. I think this is the third, perhaps the final report of the study. And what they have come up with is a certain framework of evaluating teacher efficiency. It includes teacher observation, possibly student learning scores or some kind of standardized scores and so on. So different going and looking teaching from different angles and trying to come up with some indicators that would show us that who is a good teacher and who is not. But a lot of money invested in this and a lot of interest invested in this project, so I would guess that we are going to hear more about it in the future. And then there is this is also an American example, one report about this value-added model of evaluating teacher quality, meaning that you normally take standardized test scores, measure those at one point of time, and then measure those the same test maybe a year after, and see whether the scores have improved. And then you think that if the scores have improved, it is because of the quality of the teacher. Or at least the quality of teacher has been one major factor behind that improvement in those test scores. And this approach is quite, influential. It's not a debated issue in United States, but of course when something happens in United States, it tends to also travel across borders. So I would guess that we will hear more about this value-added model also in other countries. Of course, it is a question where the teacher can affect that much if the students come from disadvantaged background, or if the teacher can always help, because there's not necessarily a full consistency from one year to another year, how much the scores of a certain pupils of certain teacher improve. In some cases they may improve, but in certain year it may go down. But in this report, the rationale for using value-added method was that it's better than the other available methods. It's not perfect, but at least it's something. That was the explanation of why we should adopt this measure to assess teacher quality. Then this comes from China. I've conducted quite a lot of research in China, but actually I'm not expert in teacher quality assessment or teacher rank system in mainland China. But this is just a figure that I found in one very very recent book. So in China, teachers have different ranks, and those ranks are based on perhaps how many years you have taught, have you made some practical research or action research, have you published some research papers, have you taken in-service training, are you taking certain responsibilities, and then you can go up in the teacher ranking system. And that is a certain kind of proxy of your quality. Of course, not every teacher in senior rank or intermediate level 1 rank is a perfect or very capable teacher. But at least that is taught to be some kind of proxy of your quality as a teacher. And then there is one quite interesting international effort to measure teacher quality, and that is the OECD TALIS survey, Teaching and Learning International Survey. And this is a survey that is very quite similar to PISA study that you probably all you know. But here, when PISA concentrates on student learning outcomes in grade 9, this concentrates more on teachers who are teaching those students. And Finland is also has participated in the latest TALIS round. I think the data was collected probably last year, and as I'm aware, the report will come out this year. So then we will know how we Finns succeed in this aspect based on this TALIS finding. But if you are interested, the previous TALIS findings are already available there in OECD webpage. But as I said, all this is quite contested. This is a Diane Ravitch is the former, I would say, advisor of the George W. Bush, who was at a certain point kind of a promoter of the no child left behind or this type of approach where you measure and standardize things. But now Diane has changed her mind and now is strongly opposing the Bill Gates of Foundation efforts, for example, to promote this teacher assessment framework. So, and Diane is one person, but there is a huge number of people who are not that happy with the efforts to measure teacher quality at the first point, and then with the tools that are used to measure teacher quality. Okay. But then to those were the, I would say, the big things that are happening in the field, and then to the small things that I've personally been involved that touch upon this issue. And if you are interested, my doctoral dissertation, recent doctoral dissertation, you can find from the University of Eastern Finland library web pages. And then there are some publications that we have done in this issue as well. And you can find those in the article databases, for example, in the University of Jyväskylä library. But what we have done is basically we have asked the teachers themselves, how good do you think you are in what you do? How good do you think you are as a teacher? And this is the actual concept is called teacher self-efficacy. But basically it's about asking people what they can do as a teacher under certain circumstances to improve student learning. So this is also some kind of proxy of teacher quality. Of course, people may tell that they are good when actually they are not that good at all. But at least it's a certain proxy of teacher quality. And then what we have collected is a questionnaire data from Finnish, Chinese, and South African in-service teachers. We have also some pre-service teachers, but here the figures come from in-service teacher data. And of course, in Finland we have teachers from different regions, from eastern and some western parts of Finland, but China is actually mostly Beijing, so you cannot generalize it to the whole China. Of course, our resources are limited and we could not cover other provinces of China. And then South Africa, and the South African data comes from different places. It's not representative, at least it's a geographically quite well distributed sample, I would say. And when the scale we used to measure teacher self-efficacy was called Teacher Self-Efficacy for Inclusive Practices Scale, but actually the items were quite general teacher efficacy items. And here are some examples. We asked them, for example, I am able to provide an alternate explanation or example when students are confused. just the kind of things that were mentioned, that does the teacher repeat his or herself when the students don't understand, or does the teacher have skills to kind of vary the instruction according to student needs? And that sort of things. And then some items, for example, from student behavior, I can control disruptive behavior in classroom, so classroom management type of questions. And then I can collaborate with other professionals, so efficacy in collaboration. And actually, these were when we did some confirmatory factor analysis, we found out that these kind of dimensions of teacher self-efficacy, or you could call it a proxy of teacher quality, could be found in the data. So efficacy instruction, how good I am in teaching, instructing to students, how good efficacy in collaboration, meaning how good am I in collaborating with parents and families and other professionals, and then efficacy in managing behavior, meaning that how good I'm in classroom management and preventing behavior issues from happening. And these figures come from a Chinese sample, but actually we could replicate this structure in other countries as well. And these numbers, they are just correlations, so it shows that these dimensions are not separate. They have a certain connection to each other, because the correlations are quite high. And then these are the actual levels of self-efficacy in different countries. And from just looking in these figures, we could say that Finland has the worst teachers, then the China, and then South Africa. But of course, this is a contextual thing. You ask people, and they think, how am I doing in my own context? And perhaps different things are required in different contexts, or different things are challenging in different contexts. For example, in managing behavior, it seems that the Finnish teachers are doing really bad in many, or not really bad, but worse than other teachers. You must notice the scale is from 1 to 6, so 4 is not that bad, but it's still worse than the other teachers. But I've been quite a lot in China. My experience is that the teachers don't experience that much challenging behavior, for example, in Chinese classroom. So it may be that Chinese teachers feel they are good or better in classroom management, because there is not that much need to actually be involved in preventing disruptive behavior. So you can see that international comparison of teacher quality or teacher efficacy is not a very simple thing. And if you just look for mean values, you it's very likely that you may overinterpret certain numbers. That's what I have to say. And then one interesting finding that has been also replicated in all our countries: when you asked the teachers, we tested that what aspect of this efficacy is most connected or to, for example, attitude towards inclusive education, meaning that can I accept different kind of students in my classroom, or do I see it as a threat? We noticed that the efficacy in collaboration is most strongly connected to attitude towards inclusive education, meaning that the teachers who think that I'm able to collaborate with others do not see so many threats in teaching a classroom with diverse learners. And this is something that I would kind of take of message, is that when we measure teachers, and this was replicated also in the Finnish sample, it was the only statistically significant connection. These are called beta coefficients, standardized beta coefficients, meaning that the closer the value is to 1, the stronger the connection between these two things. And this is already a quite strong connection, especially in China, but also in Finland. So some conclusions is that huge sums are currently being invested in measuring teacher quality, both governmental money and private money or foundation money. So of course there are firms that try to benefit from this trend, so they want to make profit of providing their tools to measure teacher quality, but also there are non-profit or or non-profit, but not necessarily they are non-profit, but the foundations have their agenda at least. So there are huge foundations investing in this efforts. But it's the question still, is it possible to reliably measure teacher quality? Of course, there can be some measures, but when you do decisions like to fire teachers or hire teachers or raise the salary of teachers with thousands of euros, you should have quite reliable measure in order to do that sort of decisions. And then, is it possible to compare teacher quality between countries when the contextual demands are so different? In teaching a classroom, for example, in South Africa requires different set of skills than teaching a classroom in Finland. And then the question of whose quality should we measure when we are talking about teacher quality? Here we saw figures that it may be that the collaboration between teachers and professional parents, the whole school community, may be a more important thing in improving quality than just individual teacher. So, is there any point of find the best teachers, when maybe it would be more useful to at least have good enough teachers and then make them to work together so that they could provide the best quality education to all children. And that's about all I had to say today, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Olli-Pekka. And now there is a room for questions or comments. William, by the moment, so you will be online.
Hello, thank you for the interesting findings of your research. I would like to find out if you, during your research, by any chance, find out any connection between teacher education and then teachers' self-efficacy? And if so, what factors do you think, within teacher education program, will improve teachers' self-efficacy?
Yes, I've done at least in China, we collected some in-service teacher data. And the finding we had was that in China there are, we had some, for example, special education majors, general education majors, early childhood education majors, then some people who studied mathematics or something like, probably they will become mathematics teachers or subject teachers. And actually, I think our finding was that those teachers who, I would say, should know most about, for example, teaching inclusive education classrooms, for example, special education students, sometimes they have the lowest self-efficacy. So the more you know, maybe sometimes the more you know how demanding it is to do all the things that are required from, at least in attitude measures, we have had this finding. Sometimes the people, the more aware they are of all the challenges, the more, I would say, the scared or not scared, but the they are to claim that, yes, this is something that I can do. Yeah, but it's also finding in efficacy, some other efficacy studies, that many times the teacher self-efficacy, it goes up during the teacher training, the initial teacher training. When you start actually teaching, it goes down. It doesn't mean that now you are a worse teacher than you were before, because you gain experience, you should be better, but you actually realize how demanding it is. And then hopefully after a decade or two, it starts to go up again, and you gain some self-confidence.
So, thank you very much. Next. presentation will be soon to be called Dr. Hanna, and she's been carried out interesting studies in Tanzania, and she has given us the title of Contribution of Qualitative Research to EFA Monitoring in Tanzania. Handy mic.
Maybe I'll use this one. I don't have a pocket.
Yeah.
Good. Or you could prepare this one. Maybe, yeah. If this is okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good afternoon. I will take you from China to Tanzania and from teachers to students. So I'm here to talk about a Finnish-Tanzanian research project that focused on female students, and it was coordinated from University of Jyväskylä. Our project is an example of contribution of research to development cooperation. Also, in terms of funding, the funding instrument is joined by the Academy of Finland and the Ministry for Foreign Affairs. And in practice, this means that in addition to reviewing the scientific quality of the research proposals, the projects are assessed against their contacts with developing countries and their development policy relevance and with regards to the impact and applicability of the expected research results. So based on these criteria, we formulated the project objectives, as you can see here. In our pre-study, we found
In our pre-study, we found that the existing monitoring and evaluation mechanisms with regards to, for example, gender equality and disability, they are too narrow to catch the critical factors regarding equality. The questions we asked in our research included, for example, how have girls and women, also with disabilities, succeeded to proceed to higher levels of education? Against all the odds, we see the figures show something, but still there are some women there. How did they do it? We wanted to ask the girls and women themselves, what do they consider critical to their advancement? How did they make it? And today I will also talk a little bit about what they said about the quality. What can we learn from the experiences of the successful girls and women? And how could their voices be included in the research policy practice dialogue on education? And of course, how can this kind of knowledge contribute to policy planning and implementation? Briefly about our findings. From the perspectives of girls and women, some of them still enrolled in secondary education, some already completed higher education. Access and advancement to education are social processes tied to a complex set of personal, institutional, and sociocultural factors. And I have a figure from my own work that was conducted among lower secondary school students. The students considered these issues to be critical to their own advancement. You see, there are the socio-cultural dimensions, economic dimensions, enabling and constraining contexts. And from what you can see within the four different fields, there are only two things that directly relate to the schools, the teachers and the peers. So from the students' perspectives, it's about so many other things. And I think this clearly shows how narrow the focus of education policy is. And that's why we need to understand what's beyond the education sector, and we need to collaborate between sectors.
Let me go back.
Two other critical findings. The students really take the responsibility of their success to themselves. And what happens if there are no basic conditions to succeed and to go forward within the system? We are creating a false sense of failure to the students. But the students, they don't think about the walls or the latrines. They think about their own motivation and their own ambition. During the transitions between different levels of education, I was particularly looking at the transition from lower secondary to upper secondary, but this definitely relates to all the other transitions as well. The role of family becomes critical. They are the one who give the motivation, and they give the conditions, or they prevent the students from advancing in education. And in my study, I got some really, really powerful evidence on the students' willingness to share their views and to participate in improvement of education. There are very few occasions when students, especially female students, are asked anything about education. And this is something we should think of on how to take this forward. A few thoughts about quality. Joanna referred to the learning crisis globally. Two examples from Tanzania. Inequalities in learning outcomes are striking. The learning achievement, particularly in community schools that actually form a major part of the secondary education sector, they are alarmingly low. The pass rates in national examinations are decreasing. We have a colleague from Tanzania who could talk more about this. There are heated debates. The media is full of discussion. I just put up one example of a news headline from October: Form 4 exams rot. There are severe concerns over quality and calls to revise the examination system. In our research, there are few indications of quality and how the female students consider quality. A colleague of mine did her research amongst women with higher education in Tanzania, and I think all of these women had actually gone through a single-sex boarding school. And these women thought this was the critical factor. They wouldn't have gone that far, and they wouldn't have achieved so well if they did not have the conducive environment. How can we create similar environments in other types of schools? This is something we should think of. In my data, the students, as I already mentioned, they emphasize the role of teachers and peer learning in increasing the quality of their learning. They thought teachers and peers were really able to help them to pursue their own goals. In my data, I had students from both public and private schools, formal, non-formal schools. And the students in non-formal schools, they had serious concerns about valuation of their credentials. And they really encouraged more dialogue between public and the private schools. Some critical challenges. The gap between youth aspirations and opportunities is widening due to the rapid expansion and deterioration of quality. So obviously there's a need for realistic counseling of the students and recognition of nonlinear paths. They should be recognized, and we should look into more into these second chances programs that we have referred to this afternoon. We found that the students' experiences do provide complementary views to the current challenges, and students have relevant recommendations on how to improve the system. The question is, how can their voices be heard and utilized? And how do we include the silenced voices going beyond the level of, let's say, student parliaments on the school? How do we include the voices of the students who have dropped out, or the female students who never speak up in the groups? We recommend that the existing research should be better utilized. There is some research there, but it doesn't get out. And we need further research utilizing actor-centered and voice-centered methodologies to get the insights. I will conclude by putting forward a few ideas for future. To complement the current monitoring and evaluation mechanisms, we should further develop contextually relevant student-centered methods. This is not easy. I have struggled with my research due to many cultural and contextual reasons, including power relations, and I mean, who is supposed to talk and who is supposed to listen. So we have to be quite sensitive when we implement this kind of research. We have found some evidence of the potential of initiating student voice research in teacher education, and this could help to increase the future teachers' understanding of the students' views. And I believe this kind of a dialogic approach could increase the quality of the teaching learning process and the understanding of teachers. They should really know their students, and they should be trained to get to know their students. We also need to find ways to increase research engagement in policy dialogue. This is a continuous challenge for all academics. And strengthening South-South and North-South research collaboration for capacity development. I think, our project has involved both Finnish and Tanzanian research, but we feel we need to work a lot more on how to truly collaborate when implementing qualitative research. I see my limitations as a Western researcher going to Tanzanian schools without knowing the language. We need to find ways on how to truly collaborate when doing this kind of research. Thank you.
Thank you, Hanna, very much for the fresh feelings after carrying out for a couple of years studies in Tanzanian context, girls, women, and education. Comments, questions right away.
Could I ask our new Tanzanian colleague to give fresh comments or reactions? He has just arrived yesterday.
Yeah.
I would really like to get a reaction from you.
Thank you very much. I'm Said from Tanzania. Yeah, thank you very much for the presentation. I think you have done a very good job, and so far I don't have any specific comment to what you have presented. But if you can just give your experience on the issue of language, You know, in Tanzania, we use English as a medium of instruction, and not many people are happy about this. They would like Swahili, but the government policy is still that they should use English. So to what extent do you think it can hinder educational development, specifically among female students? Okay.
Your question is very political, and I don't think I want to take a clear position on that one. But I can speak about my experience as a researcher, and as a qualitative researcher. First, I thought I would try to do my interviews, for example, in English. But it soon became evident that the students who have already gone to school for 10, 11 years, they are not able to discuss these things in English. And we are still talking about things that are closely related to their everyday lives and experiences. We don't go into details of physics. We talk about family and things like this. And it was impossible. So I'm not sure if there's a way of reaching understanding if you use a language that you don't properly know. I think this is all I want to say at this point. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And in many other African countries too, yes.
Jussi.
Thank you. A comment inspired by both Hanna's and Olli-Pekka's presentation, thinking about the global education reform and also beyond 2015, the future. Post-2015 education-related goals, I think the observation is clear. That comes very clearly from the Global Monetary Report and all other information we have that there's something wrong in the teaching and learning process. Learning achievement globally and many countries in the developing world. The next step, where to focus, I think that's also relatively well justified. Early grade reading, early grade mathematics, they are very important. So teaching and learning in the first grades in the school and also before going to school in early childhood development. Something which links also to Heikki Lyytinen's presentation. But then what seems to be happening, and some of the studies that Olli-Pekka was highlighting, Learning Metrics Task Force is trying to provide a platform of measuring learning achievement at the global level, various aspects in quality, and that is indeed needed in the at the global level in the post 2015 net goal framework. However, I have some doubts that setting global minimum standards and measuring against those standards might not be the best way. And I see too much of that kind of an approach, that setting standards, holding people, teachers, and other people accountable against those standards seems to be the prevailing ideology, and that might lead to a race to the bottom if these are the measurements and standards become the key issue in the debate. Rather, I would say that strengthening national assessment systems, measuring against the goals and objectives set in national curriculum, and all that deeper understanding about the teaching and learning process that you've spoken about, that should be informing policy. At the same time, we have to recognize that, for instance, OECD studies, international learning achievement studies like PISA and PIAAC, they indeed inform policy and incentivize action. Perhaps regional studies like SACMEC in Southern Africa and Western Africa also incentivize action to some extent, but perhaps to a lesser extent. So that's a big dilemma, how you need to have these international comparative studies and international benchmarks in a way, but I think you should try to combine it at the national level with this deeper understanding about the teaching and learning and what are the real bottlenecks in each context. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Hanna. Now we will continue forward, and there will be a little story about experiences. And Mama Mäki, Dr. Onerva Mäki, will describe us a little about Stafrica training. Is that possible? Just a few free memories, Dr. Onerva Mäki, Mama Mäki, is UNESCO rewarded with Comenius Prize a couple of years ago, she is a well-known teacher education, especially in special education teacher education programs during 5 decades. Here in Jyväskylä, there was carried out so-called Stafrica courses in 1980s, mid-80s until the end of 1980s, and quite a group of African students were trained here. So I give the floor for you, Onerva.
Thank you very much, and dear colleagues. I'm always giving a word in the end, so I'm very pleased to do it. It's Jussi who is getting the honor to close the seminar. This latest presentation brought up some memories on how in the future you should target the research taking an individual into the mainstream. And as you, there was not anything very new in your research findings, but it gave a basement for doing further research. And the further research, I think, should be how to create, how to support the self-esteem of the persons who are exceptional and starting the school. How much we can use the information from special education to find out or first grade already the strengths of the child and support it, and that way to create the self-esteem to face all the different strengths which are against the studies in a way. I think that research would be very important. We have in Finland had, especially Vaskola University I know, have had a long tradition of connection with UNESCO. Already Niilo Mäki was the one UNESCO's special sections, and then after him, the professor rector of the university, Martti Takala, was the one who supported all the developments which was faced to find out so-called third world problems. Even his one session he said that when I retire, I will work as a professor in Zambia University. He never reached that far, but he was always supporting all that those activities which we had with UNESCO. And I miss that there is not more from our teacher training college here now present, because I think to know more about the world, what UNESCO does and how we, through the governmental organizations and ministries, can support the international aerial education in order. So knowing this, and I have had opportunity from first of my teacher years, been working with exceptional children and teacher training. So I was also present with different international organizations, and in one of them was UNESCO organized organization. They were, people were discussing how and what we can do to better the life of the people who does not have enough education, and like people from Africa and mainly from Africa at that time. And I was present there and I heard what the Britain said, and we can do this and this, and the French says, oh, we can do this and so on. And I was silent, as at that time the Finnish people was just behind the language barrier. We didn't know so much English and so on. So I was wondering, we can do the same. What are they doing so much better than we do? Then I was coming back to Jyväskylä, and I went to the teacher training and tell them, now we have to do something also, because we have excellent special teacher training in Finland. Why couldn't we help the countries who are missing it? It was something new in 1980s. But I don't know, were they afraid of me if they say no? Because they said, yes, yes, we are interested about that. So we prepared a nice curriculum and went over to the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Jussi was not that time there yet. So, and then we wanted to train teachers from Africa. We would like to give them 3 months training to in the, all those special education studies we had. 3 months training, you know. Okay, we waited, no answer, no answer. Whole year went on, no answer. Okay, ministry does not always answer, but we were not satisfied. I went over to there and tried to find somebody who would be interested about this kind of training. And I found one name who was also known as a reporter in papers. So I went to her and told about this problem we had. And she said, I will find your paper. And finally she called me back and said, that was 1 month ago, after 1 month, she came and told, look, the person you have presented this paper is now in Tanzania, and she has taken this paper with her, so we have not any papers here left. But please do as quick as you can a new paper we can proceed with. Okay, it was sometimes in September, and we were all ready to make a 3 months training for teachers to be trained in special education. And what happened? Then there was this December we get from Minister of Foreign Affairs, we have given you taken your application, and now we wish that you will start training teachers in special education from 5 East African countries for a year. And there we were, you know, in English, teaching in Jyväskylä in English. Okay. I was teaching, that time training special teachers for hearing and visually impaired. I knew my students, I knew they are excellent in English. And we have had also the specialist in our teacher training in different areas like audiology and technology and so on. And I know that they knew English. Okay, you started preparing this English curriculum, which we made according our own curriculum. Of course, it is not was not accepted in Africa that way, but we were ready to move it and modulate it. And then Kari Karanko came in January 1982, and then he said that, okay, you are going to take from Kenya, Zambia, Tanzania, Ethiopia, Zimbabwe, and SWAPO students to be trained, special teachers. And so, you know, we had to find the trainers, we had to find the leaders of this, but we found very good persons. One was from school for hearing impaired, very excellent student teacher, and I know she's a good teacher, she knows English, and so on. And I put her to make application. And then the final day came and she was still, I was writing it, her application, and her husband, who was a principal, came there and said, what kind of director is going to be who doesn't know even how to make an application? But she was very excellent. And so on, we went on, and in the end of the year, in the end of that term, we have everything ready, and we were supposed to go and recruit the students. I take your time because this is very interesting how people from Jyväskylä who never had been doing this in English or in Africa, how we recruit the students to this course. And of course we work together with the Minister of Education. The Minister of Education in those countries would select the candidates. And we were going to the two or three of us, and when we went to Kenya, first place was according our schedule. There was no candidates which we should recruit. So we said, we give you 1 week's time, we travel to Tanzania and so on. In Kenya, when we came there, we had to have 5 teachers. We found out these teachers and then we discuss with the ministry people and say, no, it is not good. This is not good selection. There are not enough women in this group. Okay, then we went around again. This is not good. It's not curious enough. There are two more laws again and again. It takes a long time before we found these 5. In the end, there was only 1 which we selected. All the others came from other side. But it happened. It was good. Now we trained for three years, and was 54 special teachers trained. And from that on, Jyväskylä University went on so that Minister of Foreign Affairs said us, now you can try to make a new approach, new applications. So we had a meeting where we had this all countries present, and they made their own applications, and then Minister of Foreign Affairs took the one from Ethiopia at that time, and later from Namibia, and also from Zambia. So we went on this way up to this time when we are now having as good programs, training people from many African countries and so on. And I think we are all the time developing to that that direction, that we don't invite people here to be trained. We train the people in their own countries with the capacity they have, which we have trained earlier. And now it goes on, and people takes over this thing. And I'm very pleased to see that now we little by little enter to the point that we can be supporting, we can be here giving our knowledge where it is needed, but we don't send anymore our new young people to give expertise to the low African ones, because the Africans has grown up here and the discussion has to be in other ways. We have to respect and to learn to respect other cultures and work together is the challenge which we now face. So thank you for UNESCO, right? This opened eyes for many people and this will grow, and happy to see that you traveled over here and gave us, besides of this excellent knowledge, also again a new start to think something new. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much, Dr. Onerva. We need big steps, we need small steps, and always we need humans to make the change and transformations in the societies. And Onerva and her experience and the colleagues here made a good work to start to make something happening in the reality. So then the people, the trained special education teachers have had a lot to contribute in their own societies. And one of them actually is today working as a vice minister of education in Ethiopia. So many of them have proceeded quite nice in their working life and also academic careers. Thank you once more. And then we are approaching close to the final, and almost the final words will give Jussi Isokoski, Jussi Karakoski, who is education advisor in the Ministry for Foreign Affairs. Please.
Good afternoon, everybody. I was asked not to give closing remarks, but reflect on the issues coming up in the Global Monitoring Report from the perspective of Finnish development policy and development cooperation. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'll be very brief and hopefully also clear in what I try to say. Starting from the report, it's a very rich material. I've just read the summary in the train here, and I'll definitely go back to the report and study it, and hope you'll do the same. In the report, what catches my eye, there are again some very striking observations. One, this time around is that in any education system is only as good as its teachers. That is very true. Also, something striking is that inequality in educational attainment has remained unchanged over the last decade in terms of rural-urban divide or poorest and richest divide. That is also a fact that is not very positive, and that should incentivize action at the global level and at the national level. Another striking statement was, that was already discussed, 10% of global investment or spending in primary education is being wasted, since 250 million students or pupils are not learning even the basics. So these are the kinds of issues at the global level that both national governments and donor agencies should really pay attention to. And I think we try to do that. If we think about Finland's development policy, first of all, we have to look at our overall commitment to ODA, or international assistance. Our commitment is towards 0.7% of GNP, but in fact, there's been very slow growth towards that target, and we're still somewhere around 0.56, or I don't remember the last digit for sure. But Finland is committed to poverty reduction within the framework of the Millennium Development Goals. We are actively discussing future development goals beyond 2015. And at the moment, education is firmly among those priorities within the MDG framework, and as stated and defined as priority in our development policy. Our development policy program, one of the four pillars in that is human development within the overall human rights-based approach. And there, education is strongly emphasized. So education and training have, as a result of this new government's development policy, gained in priority very clearly compared to the previous government development policy. Currently, education is increasing both in absolute terms and as percentage of total aid. In 2012, which is the last official data that we have, roughly 7% of total sectorally allocated ODA or aid, plus a big share of our multilateral aid through the European Union, United Nations organizations, World Bank, and other development banks went to education. You can always argue that, as some NGOs, for instance, argue that the percentage should be higher, but if we look at compared to any other sectors, education is among those with the highest percentage of aid. And this education cooperation is expected to rise in 2013, so we'll get the figures in the next couple of months. We also have a relatively high proportion to primary and basic education within this portfolio. Some countries are named and shamed in the global monitoring report every year for including so-called imputed student costs, university student costs, in their official development assistance. Finland is not doing that. Foreign students study in Finland without us using development aid money for that. And we don't report that back to OECD. We also feel that evidence is indeed informing policy development policy in many ways, both at the level of our partner countries, where we have policy dialogue with the governments, and at the level of Finnish development policy and aid, and also aid in practice. More attention is being paid to quality issues, equity issues, and conflict-affected states, all issues that have been highlighted in this year's Global Monitoring Report. So more focus is the focus is geared towards those countries and those marginalized groups furthest away from the EFA goals. We have some very new initiatives in line with these policy priorities in relation to the need to recruit 1.6 million additional teachers by 2015. Finland is supporting recruitment of all the salaries of teachers in several countries, including Nepal and Mozambique. Finland is also supporting teacher training in many countries, Ethiopia, Nepal, Mozambique, just to name a few. We are especially targeting actions towards several marginalized groups like disabled learners, currently, for instance, in Ethiopia, and several other equity issues, including girls' education, for instance, in Afghanistan at the moment, ethnic minorities or linguistic minorities through mother tongue education or intercultural bilingual education, or whatever the name in a given country. For instance, in Mozambique. Considering the second chance options and the illiteracy program, literacy programs are not something that we've support at the grand scale so far, but we are now considering support through UNESCO to the female literacy program in Afghanistan. So hopefully we'll be able to make a decision on that later on this year. So these are just some of the initiatives in one way or another informed by the global evidence and evidence, similar evidence coming from our partner countries. I somehow have a feeling that, as Onerva was saying, that times have changed, we have to find new ways of doing these things, but at the same time, I feel that we have some reason to reinvent the wheel in some issues, and teacher-related issues is one I have in mind. Development cooperation has changed over the years in many ways from those years in the 80s. So I'm not advocating bringing more people from our partner countries to study in Finland. There must be other ways of supporting processes in countries. But at the same time, I feel we need to mobilize that expertise in Finland in a new way, because in recent years, we've been supporting financially our partner governments through budget support, general budget support, sector budget support, big pool funding programs, but that trend away from traditional projects has left very little room for those Finnish teachers or other education professionals interested in collaboration to engage. And mainly university cooperation and NGO support has been the avenue for those people who have that interest. And I think we have to find ways of utilizing the expertise we have in Finland. And one way, just to name one initiative which some of you might have heard, is Teachers Without Borders, which is a new network and initiative currently coordinated by FinChurch Aid, Kirkon Ulkomaanapu, and having as background support organizations the Ministry of Education and Culture, National Board of Education, Opettajien Ammattijärjestö, OIJ, Teachers Union, Ministry for Foreign Affairs, SIMO, the teacher colleges, several teacher colleges in Finland, teacher training institutions. And the aim aim of this initiative is exactly that, provide teachers and other education professionals opportunities to combine global education in schools and classrooms in Finland with opportunities to volunteer, do volunteer work, and especially we try to focus this to conflict affected countries, refugee camps, other situations where the human resources is critical. Teacher training or training of trainers is one way of bringing external expertise to situations like that. And first, teachers have already been selected, and they will be placed within this initiative, and you'll definitely hear more about that in the next coming months if you haven't done so. So these are just some ideas and some of the responses, not in a very structured way, but just as an example how the global evidence is informing development policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jussi. Do you want to ask something from Jussi right away? Hanna.
Thank you. Could I ask you to reflect on the role of development research with regards to development cooperation in education at the moment?
Research as a whole, I would say, is not very systematically used in our ministry. We have formerly had a separate kind of a tailor-made research allocation grant that we could use for more study type, not basic research type, but more targeted research or studies, reviews, which were more closely linked with the development policy. That funding, because we had funding cuts, that was at some point that was cut from the budget, and I think it's very unfortunate. Development research, as financed by our ministry through Academy of Finland, is, and rightly so, it's based on academic merit. It's assessed as academic research applications are assessed in the Academy of Finland system. So that you mentioned that development policy relevance, that is in the criteria, yes, but still it doesn't affect the decisions in most cases. If we have two applications which are graded exactly the same, then that development policy research or our assessment from the ministry might make the difference, but in most cases it's not the decisive factor. It's the within the basic criteria set, it's the academic merit of the applications which makes the difference, and that has some implications. So in my personal view is that not those selected for funding are not necessarily the most useful for our development policy. They might be useful for the research community, but not so much for our ministry. And I think there's not enough interaction at the moment between the research community and the practitioners in the ministry and in the broader stakeholder groups. So I think there needs to be some more thinking how to improve the system as a whole without giving away this academic justification for grants. So, but having said this, there's been over the years not so many research studies financed by the Academy of Finland, but those that have been financed in education or related to education have been very relevant from my personal view. So I've been quite happy with that kind of research that has been financed in education, but within the broader package of research, I'm still of that opinion that it could be made more policy relevant.
Good. Thank you very much. Would you give me the mic so that?
Yes, I will.
Thank you. It's time to come to end our day afternoon session for this GMR launching, and I would like to once more thank you, Joanna, on behalf of the university and the faculty for your traveling here and spending your time with us. Hope to see you again here, and it was very important for us that you came from UNESCO to us to share the knowledge and fresh information of the book. We'll take a look about it, and everybody is free to take some copies with you, share the information, visit the website so you will get the information there. Thank you very much also Olli-Pekka, Onerva, Hanna, and Jussi, sharing your time and thinking before what you are going to present us. You gave us good ideas, good visions, what to think about it, of the teaching and learning quality. Not only talking that just send them somewhere and hope that something happens to the kids there. They need really quality education, people who know how and what. Finally, I'll give the floor for Crystal Green to end words. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matti. And on behalf of the Faculty of Education again and the University of Jyväskylä, I want to extend our warmest thanks to all of you for coming today, and especially thanks to Joanna and to Hanna and to Jussi, who've come from outside of the university. And all of the presenters today, and I think all of us came here to celebrate the launch of this report because of students and teachers, researchers and educationalists, we already know that education transforms lives. We're convinced that education is not a privilege for the few who live in the right region, or have the right income, or speak the right language. That education is not just for those who are of the right gender, or have the right abilities. But education is a right. And to us, many of the results from this report seem intuitive. That as the head of the household in Ethiopia, completing primary school education means my family is less likely to be chronically poor. That as a pregnant woman in Mali who can read, I'm more likely to give birth with the aid of a skilled birth attendant, improving the chances of survival for myself and my child. That in India, as Kari told us earlier, women with higher levels of education get married later, have fewer children, and are more likely to be politically active in their communities. We in this room have benefited from education, and we continue to benefit from each other's education. We think of our own experiences, our parents, our grandparents, and we know that quality education has the capacity to empower people, to improve the quality of life, and to give people, especially women, control over decisions about their own lives, the lives of their children, and the future of their communities. I think it is fitting today that we host the launch of this report on teaching and learning at the University of Jyväskylä, because this institution has lived over the past 150 years an ongoing commitment to teacher education and education in the mother tongue of the Finnish people. The example Finland has set in the world for educational equity and universal access to the free and public provision of education from early childhood through university is in no small part a result of the commitment of education for all by the people who have passed through these halls, who have stood in this room before us. As part of this university, we move forward in the same spirit, opening the doors to students from around the globe and taking seriously our commitment to global responsibility. But we also know, and this report confirms in 462 pages of explicit detail, that globally, commitment to education is lagging. Mired in a lack of resources, educational provision worldwide is underfunded and often mismanaged. Many children remain excluded from full participation in education because of ability, ethnicity, language, or gender, among other reasons. For those who do attend, in many places, overcrowding, poor facilities, language of instruction, and poor teacher preparation can make schools hostile and even dangerous places for both students and teachers. Despite progress over the past decades, not a single one of the EFA goals will be met by 2015. A wealthy boy in El Salvador completes primary school, but his poor neighbor does not. A boy in Pakistan goes to school while his sister is kept home. Almost half of all out-of-school children are expected never to enroll. What is the future for these children who may never learn to read, write, or acquire basic knowledge in math and health? The situation cannot be left as it is. But thankfully, this report provides a roadmap for a way forward based on strategies from a wide range of educational environments. It is not enough that children are in school. Students must receive an education of high quality. This means developing and supporting highly trained, skilled, and motivated teachers. Through improved recruitment, teacher training and preparation, teacher distribution to disadvantaged schools, and the professionalization of teaching, it is possible that you and I, in this generation, will see the end of the global learning crisis. Making teaching a national priority is something that educationalists in Jyväskylä, Finland, know something about. The national policy and institutional transitions that have helped lead to improved teacher quality, university-based teacher preparation, and teacher professionalization, as well as universal access to free education for all, have happened within living memory in this country. As advocates for education, as researchers and teachers, we have a responsibility to know these global issues, to speak out and to remind each other, policymakers, and the world that quality, just, and equitable education is the key to ending poverty and marginalization. The stories and figures included in this report present a comprehensive picture of the global state of affairs in education. As for myself, I have never been to Ethiopia to meet heads of household. I have not traveled to visit pregnant women in Mali or sat down with a young brother and his sister in Pakistan. If they were here today, I would be eager to listen, to learn, and to know their stories. And I invite you to listen through the report, to hear the educational stories of people who are not physically present with us today, but are here within and between the lines of the Global Monitoring Report. Listening to other voices gives direction and renewed purpose to my work, research, and teaching as part of the wider context of education. It is long, but I ask you to join me, and as UC has already heard, to commit to reading the report in its entirety. As we educate ourselves about the global state of affairs, we can engage in meaningful dialogue within and beyond this community about educational provision. We can commit to advancing research and teaching about the topics addressed in this report in our own projects and classes. The reports are on the table. Please grab a report and please read it. Thank you.